Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with MilliQ Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.
Mike Rowe here with a few thoughts on my favorite sweatshirt, a classic zip-up hoodie that used to be navy blue but has since faded to what the fashionistas call a distressed indigo. It's 13 years old, soft as a flannel bathrobe, and after a few hundred dirty jobs, demonstrably and undeniably indestructible. This is the kind of sweatshirt girlfriends like to permanently borrow, but I've held on to this one because I got it from American Giant. American Giant makes all their stuff right here in the USA so they can control every link in their own supply chain. That matters, because when you buy American Giant, you not only get great quality, you create jobs for people in factory towns all over the country. No pressure, but if you give a damn about the business of making things in America, you got to support the companies who are doing it right. Go to American-Giant.com/Mike to get 20% off your first order. That's American-Giant.com/Mike.
Good afternoon, my conscious co-creators. Welcome to another edition of the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. I am very, very pleased that you are all here with me today. I've got another fascinating author in store for you today. I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. But first, of course, I have the little section from my book, Everyday Awakening. And so let me get into that, and then I'll introduce my guest in just a moment. So from Everyday Awakening, standing up for the right thing can feel lonely until we see the impact. Sometimes when we stand up for what we believe in, we get knocked down. We get stabbed in the back for having a conscience. We get ridiculed for opening our mouth and speaking our truth. And it feels like the entire world is turning against us. Society doesn't like when we rock the boat, especially when we have a higher standards than most. The crowd doesn't appreciate it when we call out one of their own. It can feel very lonely to take a stand. Yet we do it anyway. We do it because in our heart, we know it is the right thing to do. We don't do it to be popular. We don't do it to win favors. We do it because we have to, because of who we are, even if it appears no one appreciates us. We can't hold our tongue. We feel we must speak up and say what we see. It can feel discouraging to be the only one to make a stand. The response can make us feel like we should not have cared so much. And we may start to question whether we should have spoken up at all. Perhaps it would have been better to keep quiet, to just go along and not make a fuss. Yet we know inside that we took the proper course of action. Even though outside it feels so painful, that is, until someone comes to us and thanks us for speaking up, saying they felt the same way, admitting they didn't have the courage to come forward on their own. We may begin to learn that our stand for what is right has affected far more people than we imagined, that the response we have seen so far is just the tip of the iceberg. So, even though many people may not appreciate what we did, there may be many who do. Perhaps for a brief moment we can smile again and be encouraged to continue. And perhaps we can find a little bit of peace knowing we've helped someone we've never even met. So where can you stand up for something you feel is right and just? How can you be a beacon to those around you for a better way to live and treat others. So this section of my book, I wrote this blog a long time ago, and it was after I found out that somebody in the community had been doing something that really wasn't such a good thing. And it was because everyone thought this guy was such a good guy and he was so great and helped people and this and that, that his indiscretions were kind of brushed to the side until someone finally had a chance to speak up and say what had happened. And then all of a sudden, all these other people came forward. Oh, yeah, he did that to me too. Oh, yeah, he did that to me too. And suddenly, before you know it, there were all these people who were like, oh, my God. And suddenly we realized this person was not who he had seemed to be. And that what had been going on sort of in the shadows finally had come to light. And, you know, I was just thinking about that first person who said something, how unpopular they were, how people were saying, oh, they're just making trouble. Oh, they're crazy. They're making all these excuses. But in the truth, they were actually standing up for what they knew was right. And so it just gave me a pause for a moment to reflect on how often in society in general, like how many people have to stand up and say what is in their hearts, even when it's not popular, and be the source of ridicule and be the source of people's anger, but they still have to stand their ground. And I think those people are very special people and people who deserve our support and people who deserve to be considered and listened to and paid attention to. Doesn't mean they're always right. Doesn't mean, you know, that they always do things in the best way. But still, standing up and going against the crowd, it's never an easy thing. So this is just, I guess, my little tribute to those people who do that. And then just that kind of realization that when we do it, it can feel very lonely when you're in that position until someone comes forward and says, thank you. And then another, and then another. There's this video, and I forget the name of the video that someone showed me years ago about how you start a movement. And it starts with one crazy person standing up and dancing and all these other people around just looking at him. And then another person gets up and then another and then another and then another. And then before too long, it's a whole bunch of crazy people dancing. So I think this is a big lesson for all of us and a big lesson for life. And actually, I think this is a rather apropos section of my book for my guest, who explores a topic that not everybody takes so seriously. So let me please welcome to the show author, researcher, and explorer Marco Vigato. Marco is an Italian-born author, researcher, and explorer who has dedicated the last 15 years to uncovering the truth about the origins of civilization. Educated at Harvard and Milan's Bocconi University, he now lives in Mexico City. He is the author of the book, The Empires of Atlantis, published by Inner Traditions, and a big shout out to Inner Traditions. They've sent me some wonderful, wonderful authors, and has numerous appearances on documentaries, podcasts, TV shows, and is an expert in ancient Mesoamerica and the worldwide megalithic phenomena. In 2020, he founded the ARX Project, with the objective of uncovering more evidence of what he believes was once a global seafaring culture that vanished at the end of the last ice age. Welcome to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Marco.
Hello, Sam. It's a pleasure to be here with you on the show.
It's a pleasure to have you. It's a pleasure to have you. You know, Atlantis is one of those topics. I'm sure I've touched upon it over the years on my show years past, but I definitely haven't talked about it lately. And I'm just curious, What is it about Atlantis that like kind of started you on this path, that captured your imagination, that 15 years ago kind of made you say, you know what, I really want to understand this better?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's been the realization that the paradigm of history that we have all been taught is fundamentally wrong, or at least it's missing a fundamental episode of civilization. When you look at some of these incredible ancient megalithic sites around the world, what they show is that there was, or at least like the possibility, there has been an advanced ancient civilization on Earth before our own, and that civilization identify with that of Plato's Atlantis.
Yes, yes. I saw a long time ago this video on YouTube called "Everything You Know Is Wrong." And the gentleman, he kind of went through a whole lot of different things, but really trying to shake up people's idea of history. And over the years, and I've had on, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Dr. Sam Osmanagic, who found the pyramids in Bosnia.
Yes, with the Bosnian pyramids, of course.
Yes. And I had him, I just had him recently back on my show, but I had him on my show many, many years ago. A friend of mine introduced me to him. And the more I kind of look at things and the more you research stuff, the more you realize that like civilization is not 5,000-6,000 years old, that it is actually much, much older than that. And yet somehow we're kind of fed this story, and most people just kind of believe, oh, you know, civilization is a rather recent phenomena.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've all been told that civilization started at Sumer, so that the earliest historical civilizations were those of Sumer and Mesopotamia. But then if you go and look at the records of this civilization, what they thought, what they wrote about their own past, then you find mention of even earlier civilizations that stretch back very far into prehistory. And I think that also in the archaeological field, they were just starting to uncover more and more of the evidence of these very ancient civilizations, sites like Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey, for instance. They've literally rewritten the paradigm of history. They showed that sophisticated cultures existed on our planet already over 10,000 years ago, much earlier than anyone would have believed. And I think that we're barely just scratching the surface of the evidence of other advanced ancient civilizations.
And I've heard like there are some archaeological sites that they've now dated back to like as much as 30, 40, 50,000 years ago that we thought were only 5,000-6,000 years old. And so I'm kind of really convinced in some ways that, yeah, that civilization is much, much, much older than really we think. I'm just curious, before we go to break, what was the initial thing? What was like the first thing that made you kind of scratch your head and go, wait a minute, what's going on here? This doesn't look like the way I've been taught in school.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm also very much, I consider myself also a field researcher and an explorer as well. And so it's been my own travels, visiting probably hundreds of archaeological sites throughout the world, those incredible works and feats of ancient megalithic engineering that really showed to me and told me that something was fundamentally wrong with the paradigm of history when you're confronted with the evidence of seemingly impossible structures of engineering achievements in remote past that almost inevitably prompts the questions, who were those people? What type of civilization, what type of technology did they possess?
Right, right. And you know, one of the biggest mysteries is we still don't know how they built the pyramids in Giza, right? And that's just one example. I mean, there's sites in Peru, in South America, and in Europe. I mean, just all over the world, there are sites where it's just like we scratch our head and go, how did they do this? We couldn't do it today with our technology. So, all right, Marco.
It's hundreds of sites.
Yes, hundreds of sites. And it just, to me, it just amazes me that it's not sort of more prevalent in the media. Like, this is really something very shocking when you think about it, of what we've been brought up to believe and what's been considered true for so many generations, that now we're finding maybe it's not so true, yet you don't really hear much about it, do you?
Yeah, no, exactly. I think we need to create some of these awareness. So that's also the reason why I decided to write this book, bring the evidence of ancient advanced civilizations to a much broader public. I mean, not be aware that like research has been progressing and new evidence is constantly being uncovered for the former existence of ancient advanced civilizations on our planet.
Yes, yes. All right, wonderful. It's time for us to take our first break. So when we come back, let's talk a little bit about why you're focusing on Atlantis, you know, sort of what, you know, let's give our audience, for those who, you know, may have heard of it, but don't really know much of it, like give people an overview of, you know, the myth of Atlantis, since we don't have so many records, and sort of where that sort of search has taken you over the years. So everybody, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We're talking this hour with Marco Vigado, author of the book, The Empires of Atlantis. And we will be right back after these messages.
Are you a business owner? Do you want to be a business owner? Do you work with business owners? Hi, I'm Stephen Fry, your small and medium-sized business or SMB guy, and I'm the host of the new show, Always Friday. While I love to have fun on my show, we take those Friday feelings of freedom and clarity to discuss popular topics on the minds of SMBs today. Please join me and my various special guests on Friday at 11 a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you on edge? Hey, we live in challenging, edgy times, so let's lean in. I'm Sandra Bargeman, the host of The Edge of Every Day, which airs each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc. Tune in live with me and my friends and colleagues as we share stories and perspectives about pushing boundaries and exploring our rough edges. That's The Edge of Every Day on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Welcome back to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We're speaking this hour with Marco Vigado, author of the book, The Empires of Atlantis. So Marco, my understanding is the first sort of real written historical thing we have a mention of Atlantis or some indication was in the writings of Plato, that Plato mentioned Atlantis in, I don't remember if it was The Republic or one of his other books. But why don't you, for our audience, like give them just a brief overview of sort of the myth of Atlantis, and then what have you found over the years that kind of supports this idea of this existence of a civilization known as Atlantis?
Well, yes. So Plato is certainly the best known source of Atlantis, but it's by no means the first. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. Actually, you find the very similar traditions of Atlantis or an ancient lost civilization of the last golden age around the dozens of cultures around the world. You find that in the Egyptian records, the Sumerian records, even across the Atlantic in the ancient Mesoamerica and South America. You find very, very similar traditions, so many of which even predate the time of Plato. Now, going up into the details of Plato's story, because that's the account of Atlantis that most people are familiar with. What Plato described in his two Atlantean dialogues, the Timaeus and the Critias, actually, is this idea of a lost, very advanced civilization that fell into decadence. So the story of Atlantis, according to Plato, is really the story of the corruption and the degradation of Atlantean civilization. It was the mightiest, the most powerful and prosperous civilization that the world had ever seen. It possessed incredible technology, incredible engineering, architecture, but then they became corrupt. They fell into materialism and they started a war of conquest. They tried to subdue the entire world, and that's when divine punishment befell them. The gods decided to punish the Atlanteans that had become corrupted, and as the story goes, Atlantis was sunk in the depths of the ocean in a terrible day and night, as Plato says. And Plato also says that these events occurred 9,000 years before his time, or before the time of his grandfather Solon, which would situate the fall of Atlantis around 9,600 BC by our standards.
Right. And, you know, it's kind of funny. We talk about the Atlantic Ocean all the time, but nobody ever thinks about where does the name Atlantic comes from. And it comes from this idea of Atlantis, doesn't it?
Well, yes. So the etymology, the origin of the name of the Atlantic Ocean is unclear, because the very word Atlas or Atlan is not a Greek or an Indo-European word. So the origin of the word itself is quite mysterious. And then you have this very interesting fact that even among the ancient Mesoamerican peoples of Mexico, you had similar traditions of an original primeval that was called Aztlan, that was also allegedly located to the east, and it was the land of the gods, so where the gods came from. And very similarly, also in the Vedas, you find one original continent, so one of the seven continents of the earth. You have, like, also from a phonetical point of view, you have like very similar names that seem to designate that same land or same landmass located in the mid-Atlantic Ocean.
Right. You know, there's been a lot of myths, stories, you know, in particular, like in the New Age movement, there are a lot of people who've come up with ideas about, you know, what Atlantis was. And I'm just curious, like, you're an archaeologist, like, you're a researcher, you're somebody who looks at the facts. What have you seen in terms of actual records, in terms of the story in general of Atlantis, and what have you seen in terms of actual evidence that pointing to its actual existence?
Well, in terms of the records, and that's why I was mentioning that even though Plato probably what is the best known account of Atlantis, is by no means the only one, or even the oldest. Actually, Plato never claimed that he had come up with the story of Atlantis himself. He suggested that the story originated in Egypt, and that his great-grandfather Solon had picked it up from the Egyptian priests. Now, it's certainly interesting that in Egypt that we have a fascinating temple in Upper Egypt. It's the Temple of Edfu that contains what is considered to be one of the largest and most extensive bodies of texts that have survived from the ancient world. These are called, well, a section of those is called the Edfu building texts that have to do or deal with the mythical foundation, the mythical history of Egypt, and a time when the gods settled into Egypt. And the story that is told in those accounts is remarkably similar to the story given and the story told by Plato. It's the story of a land that was destroyed, that sunk in the ocean, and how survivors from that lost homeland resettled into Egypt thousands and thousands of years before the beginning of the historical dynastic Egyptian civilization, and these became the true founders of civilization in Egypt and in the Middle East, quite possibly also the original builders of such megalithic monuments as the pyramids, the Giza complex, many of the other megalithic structures of Lebanon. Now, it's certainly interesting that particularly if you look at Egypt, we have traditions that were preserved on documents, the Edfu building texts being one of those, but there are many other historical accounts of prehistoric dynasties like the Turin Papyrus, for instance, that stretch back over 30,000 years. So there are records that date back to pharaonic times that mention earlier dynasties of kings, demigods that ruled over Egypt in the very remote past. Now, if you combine the evidence, the textual evidence provided by these documents and by various mythical traditions with the archaeological evidence, that's when a picture starts to take shape of that civilization. Now, if we stay in Egypt, many of your listeners will probably be familiar with the theories of our geologist Robert Schock of Boston University, who advocates for a redating of the Great Sphinx of Giza. There is actually evidence that the body of the Sphinx in particular was subject to thousands of years of rainfall and water erosion that clearly must have predated the alleged time of construction of that monument around 5,000 years ago. That suggests that the Sphinx and many parts also of the Giza complex may have been carved or constructed at a time when the climate in that part of North Africa was radically different, which was not... it was the last time when you would have had sufficient rainfall to cause that type of erosion was towards the end or immediately after the end of the last ice age. So we're still talking about a time between 7,000 and 10,000 years ago. Again, suggesting the possibility that many of these monuments that were later adopted, reoccupied by later civilization may have actually been created at a much earlier epoch.
So they weren't actually created by the civilizations they thought they were. They were actually created by much earlier civilizations, but then whatever, they got taken over by those civilizations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, you talk about in your book sort of the origins of people, and, you know, the myth or the usually the accepted thing of humans sort of coming out of Africa and developing in sort of the cradle of civilization, as it's referred to. What does this evidence, how does it affect what we think about how people actually evolved over the time? Because if civilization is much older, it seems maybe people are much older too.
Right. And I think a number of recent discoveries have also put under like increasing scrutiny and put into question this idea of out of Africa or like single origin for anatomically modern humans. So right now we know, for instance, that anatomically modern humans coexisted with Neanderthals, with Denisovans, Homo floresiensis, like a whole lot of human species, like different human species that coexisted at the same time. So what they suggest in the book is that the Atlanteans, in addition to being a civilization, possibly an advanced civilization of prehistory, they may have been also their own separate human species, like a human species that evolved separately on a now sunken mid-Atlantic landmass and later mixed and interbred with other human and hominin species to give rise to what we consider today as anatomically modern humans. So it's also a different model of evolution, and one that stretches back possibly tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. It's also the time scale of human evolution is being constantly pushed back. We're constantly uncovering new evidence that pushes back in time the origins of anatomically modern humans.
Yeah. It constantly seems like things are actually much older than we think they are, that the more and more the we find out, the more and more that's uncovered, that we are actually much older than we think we are. Okay, it's time for us to take our next break, but let's talk about sort of a very important aspect of Atlantis, which you touch upon in the book, which is the apocalypse. Like, what happened to Atlantis? I mean, there's this myth of the gods coming down and destroying it, but as best as we can, maybe we should talk about a little bit of like what actually happened. And maybe there is some kind of explanation for why this advanced ancient civilization disappeared. Okay.
Perfect.
All right. So everybody, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We do this every Thursday, 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern, right here on talkradio.nyc. And you can find our video all over Facebook, Facebook Live. We're talking with Marco Vigado, author of the book, The Empires of Atlantis. And we will be right back after these messages.
Howdy, I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
Are you passionate about the conversation around racism? Hi, I'm Reverend Dr. TLC, host of the Dismantle Racism Show, which airs every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc. Join me and my amazing guests as we discuss ways to uncover, dismantle, and eradicate racism. That's Thursdays at 11 o'clock a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a small business trying to navigate the COVID-19 related employment laws? Hello, I'm Eric Sauver, employment law business law attorney and host of the new radio show, Employment Law Today. On my show, we'll have guests to discuss the common employment law challenges business owners are facing during these trying times. Tune in on Tuesday evenings from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. So, Marco, in this myth of Atlantis, you know, there's this idea that the gods come down and destroy Atlantis. I'm just curious, from an archaeological and a documentary point of view, what have you discovered about the destruction of Atlantis? Mm-hmm. Why did this very advanced, apparently very advanced civilization suddenly disappear seemingly overnight?
Well, to begin with, there were, in fact, many cataclysms that were responsible for the destruction and the downfall of Atlantis. It was not a single cataclysm. And Plato himself, even though he talks about the final destruction, the final sinking of Atlantis, he also suggests that the idea that there were multiple cataclysms, as he says, of fire and water, and that the last great flood, the last deluge, they will remember, was but the last in order of time, but there were many before that. Also, I think that this idea that Atlantis vanished in a single day and night, I think is a very simplistic view. The reality is probably that the fall, but even though the cataclysm might have been very sudden, and we'll talk about that in a moment, Atlantean civilization was not instantly wiped out. I suggest in the book that Atlantean civilization actually survived probably for centuries or thousands of years in much more diminished forms in certain parts of the world, like in the Andes Mountains in South America, in certain parts of Mediterranean Europe and the Middle East. The remnants or isolated remnants of Atlantean civilization may have survived until relatively recent times, possibly as late as the European Bronze Age or around 3,000 years ago, possibly even later than that. Now, if we go back to the time that Plato suggests as the time of the sinking of Atlantis, 9600 BC. That's a very significant date because it seems to coincide with the end of what geologists call the Younger Dryas. There was a short mini ice age, almost, a cold spell that's very mysterious in geological terms, that lasted around 1500 or 1600 years. And both the start and the end of the Younger Dryas were very abrupt, to the point that many scientists and geologists have suggested the possibility that a massive fragmenting comet actually impacted our planet at the beginning of the Younger Dryas, which was then followed by a second impact around 9600 BC. So two cometary impact at a distance of around 1500 or 1600 years. And new evidence is constantly being uncovered to the extent of the destruction that was caused by the impact. With we must think of an almost extinction level event, comparable in many ways to the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And that's exactly what we find around that time. We find evidence of mass extinctions of the mammoths, for instance, radical climate change over much of Northern Europe and North America. All these are huge polar ice caps at some point extended as far south as New York City or Chicago disappeared within the time span of just a few generations. And there is evidence, also geological evidence, of cataclysmic flooding, massive fires as well at that time. And again, I find it a very, at least a very remarkable coincidence that this is exactly, almost exactly to the year, the time frame suggested by Plato for the destruction and the sinking of Atlantis.
Right, right. So that, I mean, and that literally would have been something that would have destroyed a whole civilization overnight, a comet hitting or a fragment of a comet hitting, even a small one could have created some huge explosion and then kind of a nuclear winter type thing of throwing up stuff into the atmosphere. So there's actually real legitimate feasible ways of which a modern ancient civilization could have been destroyed. I'm just curious because there's one section of your book called The Nephilim Wars. Who were the Nephilim and what were the wars?
Well, that's, I think, a very, very old question, of course. So in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, you have this very interesting passage that quite literally suggests that the sons of the gods came unto the daughter of men, and they begot children from them, the Nephilim, like these men of renown of old. So I think there are two elements to the story. On one hand, there is this idea of the arrival of a much more advanced race, of a more advanced civilization, these sons of the gods that we find across so many different cultures, so many different mythical and religious traditions around the world, which identify with survivors from Atlantis, from the lost civilization that resettled in other parts of the world. And this idea of interbreeding or hybridization almost seems to suggest that these people did not only bring a more advanced culture and were responsible in a way for these massive surge of construction of civilizations we find at sites like Göbekli Tepe, for instance. But they also mixed and interbred with the local population. And so if we believe that these Atlanteans were, in fact, not only a superior civilization, but also a separate human species, then it's quite possible that their descendants, the Nephilim, would have possessed physical characteristics that were partially inherited from their Atlantean ancestors. So they would have been, in fact, a human Atlantean hybrids in a way. And that these are possibly what is preserved in some of these myths, which, by the way, are not unique to the Hebrew tradition. We find very similar accounts pretty much all over the world.
Right, right. And that's one of the things that's so curious is these accounts that span across multiple cultures that are very far apart. And when you think about it, if if you had remnants of the super advanced civilization, and then you had this extinction level event, and then sort of culture restarting again, but then there are some remnants of that advanced civilization, those people who were more advanced, they would seem like gods to people who were did not come from that sort of civilization.
Right, and that's the paradox, for instance, of sites like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which I think is a very fascinating site in this respect, because what you find there really upends the traditional concept of cultural evolution. The most advanced, the most sophisticated layers of that site are also the oldest. And then you see it's as if that civilization forgot, in a way, like the advanced culture, how to build in stone, how to create this kind of megalithic structure. So civilization had any way to start over again.
Right. You know, I was looking through, you have some wonderful pictures in the middle of the book, and I noticed just because my family is in Israel, and I noticed you had some pictures in Israel, and I remembered, because I saw it in here, that under the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, you can actually go underneath and you can find that there's this, what they call it, a keystone, that's this giant stone that they have no idea how it got there, but it's like the base of the temple that was built. So tell me, why did you include that, and why is that like a hint, a clue of something more advanced?
Well, there is evidence that many of these very important sacred sites throughout North Africa, the Middle East, Europe, were actually built or rebuilt on top of much earlier foundations. So what I think the megalithic evidence from the Temple Mount of Jerusalem, which you talk about, it's visible in these Kotel tunnels, and it's called like master cores. It's immense blocks of stone. You have like a single block of stone there is estimated weight over 460 tons. And this is a style of megalithic construction that you find in Egypt, almost identical. You find it in Lebanon at Baalbek, for instance, where you have even like over 1,000 ton stone blocks that were employed in this construction. And then you see how these sites were later reoccupied and reused by later civilizations. So the same way as at Baalbek, for instance, you find this incredible megalithic platform, again, built with over 1,000 ton stone blocks, on top of which the Romans built what is actually considered to be the largest classical temple in the entire Mediterranean world, the Temple of Baalbek. In the same way, I think there is at least a possibility that the Herod's Temple in Jerusalem, this incredible work of ancient architecture and engineering, was actually built on a site that was already sacred and that may have contained the remnants of even earlier structures. So when you actually compare the architecture of the Herodian period and the Solomonic period as well, you can clearly see a difference in how that may have been erected on top of some much earlier megalithic foundations that already existed at the site that I suggest may date back thousands of years, maybe even to the time of the last ice age.
Yeah. And not only, not just the sheer size of the stones, but sometimes just the how perfectly they're laid and how perfectly they're cut. Like there's the site, I forget the name, there's the site in Peru where the stone blocks are cut so perfectly even at perfect right angles that it sort of defies explanation, unless there was a more advanced civilization that was much older, which that actually created those structures.
And it's not only that, of course, it's the great size of the blocks, it's the accuracy of the construction, but it also certainly hints like the fact that the same metrological system, the same units of measurement were employed at many of these sites. You find like very consistently, which to me, again, is a very important hint to the fact that the same culture, the same civilization created all these sites. In other words, there's some very controversial evidence from Egypt, from Peru as well, that some advanced tools, possibly even machines were employed employed in order to cut and raise some of these stone blocks. So there is actually evidence from a number of sites in Egypt of the use of very high-speed drills in order to drill into rocks as hard as granite or basalt. There is a site just a few miles north of Giza called Abu Rawash, where there is evidence on blocks of granite of the use of circular saws with a diameter of over 20 feet. So you have to imagine they would have used immense machines to cut, and the evidence is quite literally written on the stones. You see the signs, like the grooves and the tool marks on these stones that show that the advanced machines, advanced technology was used in order to create these structures. And many of these, you mentioned the Giza pyramids, you mentioned many sites in Peru, Tiwanaku in Bolivia, mm-hmm. they show a level of technology of precision that would be hard to replicate, even with the best tools of today.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, I remember reading once quite a while ago that they found some fossil in, I think it was Siberia, that was some kind of stone or igneous stone or something from a volcano, and there was a gear. There was a mm-hmm. metal gear inside, a manufactured metal gear inside, and the stone was like carbon dated to something like 400,000 or four, I don't know. I forget whether it was 450,000 years ago or 450 million years ago, but it's like some really, really ancient old time, like way before any modern sort of thing. And you think like, how could that be?
Yeah. And there is this question that is generally called all parts or out of place artifacts. These are seemingly technological artifacts that are found in layers, even geological layers, that are tens of thousands, in some cases even hundreds of thousands of years old. You have many, many examples of that. One of my favorite ones is this remarkable mechanism from Antikythera in Greece, which contains a set of cogs. It's actually been demonstrated to be probably the first astronomical computer with a calculator built to reproduce the movements of the planets, of the sun, of the moon. And that was found in a Greek shipwreck dated to 300 BC. But the technology that that implies, a level of scientific and technological advancement, is far in advance of anything that would have been available at the time.
Right. Exactly. Okay. It's time for us to take our last break of the show. When we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about the ARX project, and then also about, like, as you just mentioned, the sunken boat. Like, has there been any evidence underwater in the Atlantic Ocean or the Mediterranean Ocean of this sunken civilization? And maybe if we have time, we'll touch upon even the myth of Lemuria, which is supposedly even older than Atlantis. So everybody, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We're talking this hour with Marco Vigado, author of the book, The Empires of Atlantis. And we will be right back after these messages.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the nonprofit sector connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host the program Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
In a post-COVID world, you may have many unanswered questions regarding your health. Are you looking to live a healthier lifestyle? Do you have a desire to learn more about mental health and enhance your quality of life? Or do you just want to participate in self-understanding and awareness? I'm Frank R. Harrison, host of Frank About Health, and each Thursday, I will tackle these questions and work to enlighten you. Tune in every Thursday at 5 p.m. on talkradio.nyc, and I will be Frank About Health to advocate for all of us.
Calling all pet lovers.
Pet Avengers, assemble!
On the Professionals and Animal Lovers show, we believe the bond between animal lovers is incredibly strong. It mirrors that bond between pets and their owners. Through this program, we come together to learn, educate, and advocate.
Join us live every Wednesday at 2 p.m. at talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. So, Marco, we've been talking a lot about Atlantis and how it sunk into the ocean. Have we actually found any evidence in the water of an ancient civilization?
Well, there is a lot of evidence of many submerged cities around the world, many of which may date back to the end of the last ice age, so the supposed time of the sinking of Atlantis. Some of these evidence has been presented by authors like Graham Hancock, for instance, that talks extensively about these megalithic submerged ruins off the coast of Alexandria in Egypt, for instance, the Gulf of Cambay in the Yonaguni in Japan. So there are many examples of submerged sites. Now, when it comes to the question of Atlantis, a sunken landmass in the Atlantic Ocean, there is actually evidence that the region of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is this immense submerged mountain chain in the Mid-Atlantic Ocean, suffered episodes of cataclysmic subsidence during the recent geological time, particularly in the region of the Azores Plateau. Evidence has been found of former riverbeds that extend and run on the ocean floor for hundreds of miles off the coast of São Miguel Island in the Azores, for instance. So we can imagine that some of these mid-Atlantic islands, the Azores in particular, could be quite literally the mountain tops of a now sunken submerged landmass in the mid-Atlantic Ocean, very much in the same location as suggested by Plato for Atlantis. Something else that is, of course, like if you think about that, then what is the possibility we'll uncover any direct evidence of that? I think, of course, like there is still the hope that one day we'll actually be able to identify ruins or clearly man-made structures and artifacts from the mid-Atlantic floor. But we also have to think about how likely is it that after 10,000 years at least, we'll be able to find anything with the rate of the depositional sediments, for instance, the rate of erosion on the Atlantic floor. We're talking about depths between 2,000 and 3,000 meters, so thousands of feet. Wow. Underwater. So even with the best of the technology available today, it would be extremely hard to recover any type of artifacts. And that's why I think it's even more important that we look for evidence of these ancient civilizations in other parts of the world. I remember that this was a global civilization. It was a global seafaring culture. So even though their homeland, these lost continent, lost the landmass called Atlantis, is now vanished. Is now sunken into the depths of the Atlantic Ocean, we may still be able to find evidence of Atlantean civilization from the lands where Atlantean survivors or Atlantean colonists resettled in the Middle East, in South America, in Egypt, North Africa, and truly all over the world. And that's why we find all these many megalithic sites pretty much on every continent.
Right. So a couple of years ago, you founded something called the ARX Project. What is that all about?
Well, that goes exactly in that direction of trying to uncover some of the evidence of ancient advanced civilizations. Again, I think that if we are ever to find conclusive evidence for the existence of Atlantis, we need to actually go out there and start looking for that in places where it is likely that Atlantean survivors or colonists resettled after the cataclysm in order to restart civilization. And so the objective and the idea behind the ARX project is to actually uncover some of that evidence. There is a very strong suggestion in many ancient traditions that prior to the fall of Atlantis, various secondary centers of civilization were established in in different parts of the world. Even repositories of knowledge were created, almost like time capsules or shelters to preserve documents and artifacts from the lost civilization, with the idea that the future humanity, that is us, would one day rediscover them and bring back, in a way, the civilization and the science of Atlantis. So I think we have a responsibility now with the means provided by modern technology, by modern science, to uncover some of that evidence, to try to find some of those time capsules. And with that, bring back some of the science, some of the culture and civilization of Atlantis.
Which kind of leads me to sort of my next question. You kind of answered it already a little bit, which is, why should we care about Atlantis today? Why is all this information, how is it relevant to our lives today in this world?
Well, it's two things. So on the one hand, I think part of the reason why we're so attracted by this topic of lost civilizations of Atlantis, that our civilization is very much walking down the same path. So if you go back to the root of the Atlantis story, it's a story of a highly evolved spiritual civilization that became corrupted and fell into materialism, and eventually that's what led it to its downfall. So I see many parallels between our own, our own Western civilization and Atlantis itself. And second, I do think and I do believe in the possibility of recovering some of that Atlantean past so that we learn from the past mistakes. In the same way as during the 15th and 16th century in Europe, at the time of the Renaissance, the rediscovery of the heritage of Greece and Rome led to this great flourishing of culture and civilization in pretty much every field, from the arts to science. Imagine what the rediscovery of our Atlantean past could bring. It would be truly a new renaissance, a new golden age, almost propelled by the rediscovery of much of the science and technology of Atlantis.
Just really quick, are you familiar with the work of Zachariah Sitchin, who wrote the book The 12th Planet? So he kind of postulated that this ancient Sumerian civilization and what we refer to as gods were actually aliens. What do you feel is the likelihood of that? Or do you take a very earth-based approach to things?
Yeah, I take a completely earth-based approach. I find this whole idea of ancient aliens to be entirely unlikely, not based on facts, on the evidence. All the evidence I found, both the textual evidence, the archaeological evidence, it really points to an earth-based civilization, clearly an advanced earth-based civilization. There is nothing to make me think that extraterrestrials or aliens were involved in any way.
Okay. Real quickly, we only got a minute or two left. What was Lemuria? Because you often hear about Lemuria speaking in similar conversations as Atlantis.
Well, there is this idea, particularly in the esoteric tradition, that Atlantis was not the only lost civilization. It was probably the last in order of time, but other advanced civilizations existed even before Atlantis, one of those being Lemuria in the Indian and Pacific Ocean. So that would have existed at the time probably over a million years ago. So we're talking about like very, very ancient times. And so even the possibility of recovering, if it's hard to even like uncover some of the evidence of Atlantis, it's much closer to us in time than the possibility of ever uncovering any evidence of Lemuria. I think it's very, very small.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Marco, it's time to draw to a close. I could talk to you for hours. I love talking about these topics because I feel there's so much to be learned from them. So your book is The Empires of Atlantis, which I think that empires, multiple, plural, is very much on purpose. And you can find this on all the major booksellers, correct?
Yes. It's through all the major booksellers around the U.S. As I said, the publisher is in their tradition. It's distributed by Simon & Schuster. You can find it on Amazon, all your favorite bookstores. I also encourage you to visit my website. It's marcobigato.com, where you can find more information about the book, my latest research and expeditions around the world.
Right. And that's Marco Vigato, MarcoVigato.com. Marco, thank you so much for coming on my show today. It was a pleasure to have you on the Conscious Consultant Hour. I wish you much luck in the future.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. And if you have to promise me, if you find any great new evidence or make some great breakthrough, you let me know so we can have you back on the show.
Okay? I will. You will be the first to know.
Wonderful. And thank you, my loyal listeners, for tuning in as you do week after week. I appreciate you all. Without you, there's no show. Please stay tuned later today. We have Frank Harrison in the show, Frank About Health, and tomorrow our whole business block of shows from Philanthropy and Focus, always Friday, and Wise Content Creates Wealth. Next week on my show, I'm bringing back a returning guest, a dear, dear friend of mine and spiritual teacher, G.P. Walsh. I hope you will join us next week for that. Thank you all for tuning in. We will talk to you next week.
Are you a business owner? Do you want to be a business owner? Do you work with business owners? Hi, I'm Stephen Fry, your small and medium-sized business or SMB guy, and I'm the host of the new show, Always Friday. While I love to have fun on my show, we take those Friday feelings of freedom and clarity to discuss popular topics on the minds of SMBs today. Please join me and my various special guests on Friday at 11 a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you on edge? Hey, we live in challenging, edgy times, so let's lean in. I'm Sandra Bargeman, the host of The Edge of Every Day, which airs each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc. Tune in live with me and my friends and colleagues as we share stories and perspectives about pushing boundaries and exploring our rough edges. That's The Edge of Every Day on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Informed about menopause and how it impacts on your life? Hi, I'm Pat Duckworth, women's health strategist and host of the Hot Women Rock radio show, empowering women leaders at menopause. Join me every Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. UK time on talkradio.nyc for interviews with inspirational women who will share their top tips to rock your world.
In a post-COVID world, you may have many unanswered questions regarding your health. Are you looking to live a healthier lifestyle? Do you have a desire to learn more about mental health and enhance your quality of life? Or do you just want to participate in self-understanding and awareness? I'm Frank R. Harrison, host of Frank About Health, and each Thursday, I will tackle these questions and work to enlighten you. Tune in every Thursday at 5 p.m. on talkradio.nyc, and I will be Frank About Health to advocate for all of us.
Podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Why pay more for a separate CoQ10 supplement? Enjoy twice the benefits with SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced. From the number one doctor, pharmacist, and cardiologist recommended beet brand for heart health support, the new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced by Human is now infused with CoQ10. That's essentially like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 ingredients support nitric oxide production, healthy blood pressure, healthy CoQ10 levels, and heart-healthy energy with two tasty chews a day. Plus, SuperBeats Heart Chews Advance are plant-based, so you get heart-healthy energy without stimulants. For a limited time, Get a free 30-day supply of Super Beats Heart Chews on all bundles and 15% off your first order by going to radiobeats.com and using promo code DEAL. That's radiobeats.com, code DEAL.